Just like we need to be a unified nation in response to COVID-19, we need a unified national response to climate change. We need to meet the moment with the urgency it demands, as it would during any national emergency.
An extreme year for hurricanes, wildfires, and heat waves comes to an end.
Ada is the 28th named storm of the season. That ties it with 2005.
You could hear everything hitting the house, and it was literally moaning and cracking back and forth.
I said, Jack, are the four of us going to die in this house? See, that's how high the water got.
Outside my house, I have 18 inches of water all the way around my house.
The climate is not what it used to be. I do not remember this amount of dryness and this amount of fuel.
4 million now acres have been burned. 31 people have lost their lives. Close to 9,000 structures now have been destroyed.
I just about fell sideways. I could not believe the magnitude of the fire and how quickly it had grown. Out of control. This is insane.
You can't really go anywhere, and now, you know, but you can't go home.
In central Iowa, we recorded some wind gusts, 70, 75 miles per hour.
Think about entire counties that have been taken out. You know, over half of our crops have been devastated, about $4 billion worth of damage.
The intensity of this one kind of sets it apart. It was definitely a stronger derecho.
So I hurry up and I push the door back open, and there's this giant board just sticking out of the wall.
We're expecting up to 30 inches of rain, portions of Honduras, northern Nicaragua, Guatemala, and southern Belize. That type of rainfall can lead to life-threatening flash floods and mudslides.
We can expect to see further intensification of these extreme wildfire weather conditions.
Something's happened to the plumbing of the world. Climate change is real, and that is exacerbating this.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Callie Crossley, host and commentator for GBH Radio and TV in Boston. I'm in for Tanzina Vega this week. The pandemic may have consumed the majority of our attention this year, but it was not our only global crisis. Climate change in 2020 has led to some of the worst environmental disasters in history. There have been 41 weather disasters this year that have caused billions of dollars in damage. A record 18 of these took place in the U.S., with a year of historic wildfires, Atlantic hurricanes, and other severe weather fueled by climate change. Today, let's start with a look at the year in climate stories. What stands out, what we learned from a year when the climate crisis coincided with the coronavirus, and how we can look ahead into 2021. Joining me now is Umair Irfan, a staff writer at Vox covering climate change and science. Umair, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Callie.
And Jason Smerdon, a climate scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. Jason, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Callie. Thanks for having me.
So, Jason, taking 2020 as a whole, what has happened to this planet when it comes to climate change? And how different do things look from a year ago globally?
Well, global warming's continued. Just because we had other crises didn't mean perpetual warming trend that we've been on now for over a century. It hasn't continued. So as far as the big picture goes, this year is likely to be in the top three warmest years on record. It could even possibly be the warmest year on record. And a lot has happened as that larger context has carried us along. So the Arctic is increasing and getting warmer much faster than the globe. We saw the second lowest sea ice extent in the Arctic since the 1970s. That accompanied things like fires in Siberia. So these global impacts, as you mentioned in the intro, have continued to pace in lots of different places. Closer to home, we've seen the hurricanes and the fires that you mentioned, as well as the extreme weather.
Umair, 2020 had some of the worst wildfires and hurricanes, as we've just mentioned, on record, linked, of course, to climate change. Can you give us a sense of how this year compared to years past?
I mean, as Jason noted, like, you know, a lot of these were record setting. Like in places like California, we saw a record area burned. We saw one of the largest wildfires on record. Colorado also saw one of its largest wildfires on record. The Atlantic Hurricane Basin this year saw its most active season on record. So generally just pushing the boundaries, and not just inside the United States. We saw in other countries, like you may remember at the beginning of the year, Australia saw massive wildfires. We saw massive typhoons in the Pacific Ocean, and all of these were basically pushing the boundaries as well of what we've seen. And so it's not just that we saw a whole bunch of these things all over the world. It's that even in the individual events we saw, you know, these are outliers just by just about every measure, you know, in terms of strength, intensity, and area that these events have affected.
So, Jason, are the links between extreme weather events and climate more clear now than they were in years past? And what did 2020 do for our understanding of things like the wildfires in Australia and California and this record-breaking hurricane season?
So the links are clear, but it really depends on the event. So things like the fires that we're seeing, the hurricane intensity, the strength of storms, those have real strong connections to the changing conditions due to global warming. So for instance, with hurricanes, and Umair mentioned that in the Atlantic Basin, we had a record year. We had 30 named storms. That's larger than any thing we've had since the 1800s. And those storms are getting stronger, and the connection between climate change and stronger hurricanes is very well resolved. Mainly, the hurricanes get their strength from the warm sea surface temperatures over which they form and travel, and there's a very clear connection between increasing sea surface temperatures globally and climate change. Similarly, with fires, the warmer and drier conditions that we're seeing, for instance, in the western United States, create much more favorable conditions for fire. And once fires start, allow fires to burn hotter and over larger areas. So in California, for instance, three of the four largest fires in California history happened this year. A lot of those fires were started by things like lightning strikes. But what that kind of random event is happening on top of is much drier conditions, much more favorable for fires. So the likelihood of those fires starting as a consequence of climate change is higher. And then once they've started, there's just much more fuel for them to burn over much larger areas.
Hmm. Umair, let's talk about the effect of climate change on people worldwide this year, especially the most vulnerable. How many people have been displaced as a result of climate change, and what does the financial toll look like?
Right. I mean, as you noted at the top, this is something that's been costing economies around the world, not just the U.S. economy, billions of dollars. They had, you know, dozens of disasters this year on their own with multi-billion dollar tolls. And as a consequence of that, you know, we do see a lot of displacement. People have been forced to relocate from the coast, particularly the Gulf Coast this year in the United States. Like places like Louisiana saw multiple hurricane strikes, you know, spaced weeks apart. And so people had to be relocated. And that's even harder now with the pandemic going on and having to maintain social distancing. Similarly, in California, there were major evacuations as well out of these the paths of these massive record-breaking wildfires, and you're seeing multiple compounding disasters here, and that's kind of just exacerbating. It's not just climate change. It's also the fact that we have these systemic inequalities in our society and also things like the pandemic. And when you have all these variables intersecting, that creates a much more devastating and longer-lasting toll. That's not just measured in the dollar amounts, but also in the trauma in these communities that, you know, have to be relocated and can't go back to the places that were home for generations.
Well, Umair, let's turn to the link between climate and COVID. What are some of the primary ways the pandemic affected our climate this year?
In the big picture, you know, we saw major global economic slowdown. You know, a lot of countries started shutting down. We saw roadways clear out and a lot of industries and businesses and offices closed down. And so there was, especially at the outset, a major decline in energy consumption, and in a lot of places also a major decline in pollution. We saw, particularly in China, for instance, like pollution, like nitrogen oxides, for instance, rapidly decline in major cities as people stayed home. And we saw a big dip briefly in greenhouse gas emissions globally. But as businesses and offices and the economy started reopening, we actually saw a rebound where pollution and all these emissions all started spiking even higher than where they were before. So many of the gains were there, but they were short-lived as far as environmental benefits. And so we see now, you know, just how much of an economic dip is required to see these declines in greenhouse gas emissions, for instance. And we kind of have a better sense of what the challenge is that lies ahead as we're dealing with climate change over the coming century and trying to zero out global emissions. We get a better sense of just how much effort is involved in terms of the whole planet trying to mitigate this problem.
So, Jason, how do you think the pandemic has changed human behavior with regards to the planet? Do we know?
We know, for instance, that we're driving less and we're flying less, and that's where the big reductions in greenhouse gas emissions have occurred. And, you know, Umair presented this well. The one thing that I would say is that when we think about the kinds of changes that are necessary to decarbonize our economy, we would never pick a global pandemic as the option for doing that. So in terms of the parallels between what we need to do and what's happening under this pandemic, I think it only goes so far. But one of the things that I think is really important to take away from this is when we think about individual action, it's hard to imagine any more advanced individual actions than we've taken over this year, as many of us have stayed home, as we've stopped flying and traveling and so on. And yet, in terms of the overall number of amount of emission reductions this year, we're going to come in at probably about an 8% reduction relative to 2019 levels. And that's with a massive, essentially individual amount of actions that we've all taken that you might list as things that we need to do to curb greenhouse gas emissions. But there's still a lot of things that are fundamentally tied to fossil fuels. So we were still at home using our computers, heating our homes. That's all tied to, in many cases, electricity production, which is dependent on fossil fuels in a significant way. Industry still continued in different ways, which is still very dependent on fossil fuels. So I think one of the things that it actually demonstrated is that individual action only goes so far, and what we really need to decarbonize our economy is a much more systemic, wide-scale effort that still is within reach, but isn't something that necessarily happened during this pandemic. We were still using energy, industry was still churning its wheels, and decarbonizing those sectors is going to be much more difficult than just individual choices that we make.
So have researchers been able to learn anything new about humanity's effect on climate change because of the pandemic?
You know, there's going to be some interesting things. So there was reductions in industry, for instance, and that meant that there were fewer pollutants, industrial pollutants going into the atmosphere. And that's going to allow us to sort of understand, for instance, the impact of industrial aerosols, which also are an important feature of the climate story. They reflect sunlight in certain locations and actually cool the planet. A reduction in that is going to tell us something about how sensitive the Earth is to those aerosols. So there will be, I think, interesting experiments that have been run. But the overall story here is still that greenhouse gases have been increasing, and that the march upward in those gases and the consequence climate change is something that's continued largely unabated.
Umair, where do we stand on implementing more clean energy solutions in the U.S. in particular? I know that's something President-elect Biden has talked about.
Right. President-elect Biden has set a target of zeroing out the greenhouse gas emissions from the U.S. economy by 2050, but has also said that he wants to decarbonize the entire electricity system by about 2035. And that's just 15 years from now, which means we really have to start making aggressive changes now. In terms of practical things, I mean, we recently saw a big boost to that with this spending bill that was just passed by the government and signed into law by President Trump. This is that $900 billion COVID relief bill and also this $1.4 trillion omnibus spending bill, you know, because our Congress doesn't really do anything unless there's a crisis. Basically, they were able to pass some major energy legislation, and that contained some things like major investments in clean energy research, development, and deployment, but also updates to this treaty called the Montreal Protocol. And this is an agreement that limits pollutants that damage the ozone layer. But these same pollutants also are major heat-trapping gases. And this amendment to it, called the Kigali Amendment, basically commits the United States to phasing out these hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, by 85% over the next 15 years. And this has a huge impact on the global climate, because if you were to measure the impact of these heat-trapping gases, what we reduce would avert about half a degree of global warming by the end of the century. And also there were some extenders for tax credits for wind and solar energy development. But beyond that, you know, President-elect Biden has also set out his agenda and his team, and he's picked out several leaders that have not just really good environmental bona fides on climate change, but also social justice. Say, for instance, you know, Representative Deb Haaland, who was selected to lead the Department of the Interior. She would be the first Native American cabinet secretary, and she's also been an opponent of pipelines and drilling on public land, and also has advocated for Native American communities across the country. And similarly, Michael Regan, who was selected from the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality to head the EPA. He's also had a strong focus on climate change and the environment, but also on issues of social justice and racial and inequalities and things like that, and how the environment affects there. So we get a sense of what the priorities are going to be over the next 4 years.
Well, we've talked on this show a fair amount about what the Biden administration's climate change policy could look like, and we'll tweet some of those links out so folks can revisit those conversations. But thanks for that quick snapshot of his priorities as we understand them today. So, Jason, back to the stimulus bill. What can you walk us through the significance of what some of the impact could be to reducing the the impact of climate change, like the reduction of hydrofluorocarbons, for example?
Well, I think hydrofluorocarbons is an important one, as Umair described. You know, this is something that we replaced chlorofluorocarbons with, and that was a really important move in the context of reducing the ozone hole. But as Umair mentioned, these are incredibly potent greenhouse gases. They are 100 to 1,000 times more potent than CO2, for instance. So reducing those and really targeting those as an important greenhouse gas is important on the order of several tenths of a degree of warming that we'll save. But, you know, more important, and just I think thinking back or looking at the larger picture here, all of the team that Umair mentioned and the parts of the omnibus bill that focus on climate change measures, you know, that's just an about face from what we've had over the last 4 years with an administration that has failed to acknowledge that climate change is even an issue. So I think in terms of the seriousness with which this incoming administration is going to take climate change and the team that they're putting together, it's just a measure of the seriousness and the urgency with which the Biden administration is going to look at climate change. And frankly, that's what we need. I mean, we've lost a lot of time over the last 4 years, and we've lost a lot of time over longer periods of time really failing to address climate change with the kind of urgency that's necessary. And it's at least encouraging that these initial signs from the Biden administration and what Congress has done through the omnibus bill, that we might actually take climate change seriously with the urgency that it deserves over the next 4 years of this administration.
So following up on that, Umair, are there initiatives or policies that President Trump is enacting on his way out of office that could have long-lasting implications for climate change?
Right. I mean, as Jason mentioned, you know, the last 4 years undoing all the rollbacks on environmental regulations, on things like energy efficiency and opening public lands to mining and drilling, that's just going to be a huge agenda item. And it's going to take a long time just to undo those changes under a Biden administration. But right at between now and when President-elect Biden gets sworn in, I mean, President Trump has been signing new authorizations for drilling and mining on public lands, new rollbacks on some of these environmental regulations. Recently, there was a rollback on efficiency regulations on things like shower heads, for instance. And, you know, these are small things that actually add up to big benefits, things like, you know, getting our appliances to use less electricity and do more. Those have major effects that help redound to greenhouse gases. And so seeing those things still being done is a little bit disheartening for our ambitions in terms of limiting greenhouse gases. And that, on the other hand, though, because these are being done through the White House, through executive authority, these are things that can be undone through the White House and executive authority. And we often see this, you know, back and forth between administrations. But again, this is just going to be more things for the Biden administration to have to do in order to enact their goals and to meet their targets of, you know, zeroing out emissions from our entire economy by the middle of the century.
Jason, I know you have young kids, and I'm wondering, as a parent and climate scientist, how you're feeling about this moment. Are you hopeful?
Well, let me say a few things about kids. First of all, I have a 3 and a 5-year-old. So, you know, with regard to this being a generational issue, a lot of kids who are being born today, or kids like mine who are young, they're going to live to the end of the century, which is, you know, in the climate change world, we often project to the end of 2100, of course. Things don't stop at that point. But, you know, at this point, that's within a human lifetime. And so this, all of these negative impacts of climate change that we often project out to the end of the century, that when I started studying this seemed like it was so far away, really is within a human lifetime and is going to be the world that my kids inherit. And so, you know, that is an important thing to recognize, how close that reality is. And we have the power to shape it. We have the power to change it through our actions now, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. With regard to, you know, my kids, I think I haven't started talking to them about the doom and gloom of climate change at this point, but I will tell you what we do is we spend a lot of time outside. They're becoming they're natural naturalists in so many ways, and they're learning about their world. We go birding, they learn the names of plants and so on, even in Manhattan. And I think on some level you have to understand how significant and unique this planet is before you can appreciate the kinds of massive impacts that we're causing it. And that's what I'm trying to teach my kids at this point before we get on to the more serious stuff about what needs to be done to maintain that.
Umair, how about you? Not even as a reporter, but as a human, how do you feel as we head into 2021?
Right. I mean, I think echoing what Jason said, I mean, we're seeing a pretty abrupt change from where things were over the past 4 years. But we also have a lot of work that's cut out for us. I mean, I think we have a lot of ground to make up, the United States in particular, as a global leader and a major economy. A lot of countries are looking to us, and this is really a place where we have to step up. And, you know, as Jason noted, like, we do project out to 2100, but 2050 is also where a lot of our benchmarks are. And 2050 is the world that a lot of working adults are going to retire into. And that's it. That's an era that a lot of us are going to see right now. So it's not just for our children's future, but perhaps for our own future, for our own self-interest, that we really should be starting aggressively to mitigate our greenhouse gas emissions, because this is a world that we are going to see play out in front of us.
Umair Irfan is a staff writer at Vox, covering climate change and science, and Jason Smerdon, a climate scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University.
This is Merritt Youngblood in Wasilla, Alaska. Climate change has directly affected me and my family. Obviously, we're in Alaska. There's a lot less snow. We have a lot more ice. And we don't have a nice, fun, cold, snowy winter weather going on. I hope, with Biden coming in, to see aggressive moves away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy sources.
This is Julie from Sarasota, Florida. I sincerely hope that Biden's administration reinstates the environmental controls that Trump had let lapse or removed. And I really hope that he focuses his attention on renewable and clean energy.
This is Jean calling from Seattle, Washington. Climate change was very much in evidence this past summer with hazardous levels of wildfire smoke in our city. This made the air nearly unbreathable and increased the claustrophobia of pandemic times. We couldn't even safely go outside. I'm hoping that the Biden administration will be able to de-emphasize our reliance on fossil fuels and support solar and wind energy.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.